We're lucky today to have as our moderator and our MC, well-known author and wine journalist Jordan McKay. Jordan writes for San Francisco Magazine, for the New York Times, and is also the author of two books, one, The Passion of Pinot, and I said this morning, if you don't have it, you should, if you are passionate about Pinot, and also coming soon, The Secrets of the Sommelier. So I'm going to hand over the microphone to Jordan McKay. He's also the timekeeper, and so he's been fairly strict about it this morning, so you can blame that on me, not on him. So enjoy the afternoon.
Thanks. It's a very interesting tasting of vintage wines from Navarro going back to 1991. So quite a look back. We have the winemaker, Jim Klein, and I'm going to pass this mic to him. And I'll stay in conversation. I'll try this other mic out. And do you want to kind of go through each wine as a group, or do you want people to taste first?
I think everybody can handle this themselves. They're semi-professionals.
Okay.
So if you want to smell them and taste them and then taste them and smell them, go right ahead. Anything I say, you're going to do differently.
What do you think? I think older to younger is interesting.
Yeah, I think we're going to discuss them older to younger.
Okay, so let's do that. And I think maybe just take a second to taste at least the older wine at first. And then during that, why don't you talk a little bit, 1991 vintage, we don't have to go into all the details, but one thing that's, I think, always interesting is not just the specific weather conditions, but what was going on in winemaking at that time, and if, you know, what has changed since then, and so talk a little bit about the other things that might have impacted the style of the wine because of the time.
Sure. Great. And also, I'd like to get audience feedback kind of as we go rather than have a, you know, discussion sort of at the end. So, let's see. So this is the 1991 vintage. I did not grow and ferment this wine. I was working halfway across the world in the Golan Heights in 1991, dodging scuds earlier that year. And so I came in May of 1992, and the wine was in barrel. And so I bottled and blended this wine. So this is me at the beginning of the valley. Let's see, oops, go here. And we make big bottles and little bottles and all kinds of stuff. This is a view of Navarro Vineyards. And our Pinot Noir field is right here. It's called South Hill. This lower section is still in production. This section here has been replanted since then. It is now on clone 777. The planting at Navarro is clone 4, the Pomard clone, and we also included selections in this particular wine. There is Martini 15, and there is also a Chalon selection called David Bruce locally. This is Mark Tarula. He's standing in Valley Foothills Vineyard. This was the David Bruce area when it was first planted in 1985. And I think the point I want to make is that we make wine sort of based on decisions that were made, you know, 8 to 12 years earlier when we make great Pinot Noirs, hopefully, right? And so, you know, this was planted with 12-foot spacing, sort of John Deere spacing, if it were. And a T-top trellis eventually went in. And the wine that we're having here is next. This is Ted Bennett, the owner, and Tom Lane bending down to see what's going on there. I think that might be Bill Mitchell. I can't really tell. We developed a winemaking style called Method Leoncian, which went the old method. And so we fermented it in these old apple bins that were old with old plastic. This wine that we're having today was 20% whole clusters. And there's Tom. He went on to Con Cannon. He's making wine down in Paso Robles today. And this was fruit being delivered from that vineyard. There's Paul Arzrini on the truck there. You see Paul standing up. He runs, I don't know, he probably farms at least a third of the acres in this valley, I think, today. And this is South Hill Vineyard. And a few things have changed over time. You can find there a nice clean berm underneath the vines. We were doing native grasses, endemic grasses, but we were also using Roundup and Goal in those days and having very clean vines underneath, and we're not doing that today. You can also see that's a California sprawl with a T-top on it and very little leaf removal. And there's the whole clusters going in, and there's a lot of kind of green-looking stems there, although there's some kind of nice lignification. And then these are taken during that vintage. I hope I'm making that clear. This is pre-macro bin days, so you can see we're using these black liners. Okay, so that's this next one sort of segues into the next wine. But
And you can keep going into the next wine. I mean, I think that when I taste these, I think it's pretty interesting in a way how little they've evolved. The nose on the 91 smells sort of old a little bit. There's kind of heavy soy and some slightly washed out fruit, but on the palate, it seems to still have a lot of youthfulness and a lot of structure, you know?
Yeah, I think this wine, a couple of things. It was always a pretty youthful wine throughout this entire time. And I think that it does have a lot of youthful notes, and that's one of the reasons we brought it in. I guess I have a confession to make that's never been made publicly. There was only about 10% new oak in this wine. We were going through a budget crisis in 91, and the industry was in a bad state of affairs, and so the wines were cycled through an interstave tank to try to bump up that nose. And, you know, it doesn't look like it was much of a recession now looking back, does it? but so they cut that barrel budget. And I actually think, I've always suspected this wine was better for it. You know, it sort of makes you think twice about, some of these oak adjuvant just really is as bad or non-traditional as, you know, solely the realm of low-end winemaking, you know.
Yeah.
We all should be using whatever kind of techniques it takes to make nice wines that are lively and that can age.
Did it spend more time in older oak or in tank than
I think he cycled each of the three lots through that for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then put them into older barrels, and that was early in the age of the wine.
So there was probably less oxidation going on, too.
They were young during that period of time.
I mean,
and lazy.
In 1994, this wine would have been, was it hard? Was it tight? I mean,
it always had a great
fruit. It still is like that.
Yeah, you know, in my winemaking, I'm almost always trying to make the nicest, most pleasant-tasting wine at the time. Mm. This sort of notion that you have to make an overly extracted wine that's so drying and tannic, or that I always try to make the wine too acidic so that they can age. I think that the wines should exhibit balance at every stage of production.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on to the next one, the 94. You were there for this entire vintage, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is actually 1990, and again, my thesis that decisions made years before impact wines later on. So this is the Hammer Olson Vineyard, and it was planted in 1990. By 94, we had, you know, maybe the very first grapes coming off of it, so it was less than 5% of the blend. But in this particular vineyard, we planted grapes that were part of the Carneros Creek study in the 80s. Tom had been doing his master's thesis on that. So there was Martini 15 was identified as doing pretty well in that study in the Carneros. There were no Dijon clones to plant. Those didn't come through until about 1995, I think. Oh, no, actually we planted some. We had Dijon 115 that we put in 93. So, and again, the warning this morning about not planting field selections or suitcase selections is true. The Chalon grapes are nice, but there's virus there, and they, I think, had about a half failure when they first planted the vineyard just because of virus failures. Go back. And then this is also 1994, looking down to Hammer Olson Field in 1994. And you can see it was fully up and it was mature. And let's see, 1994 was a fairly warm spring. We had harvest from the 19th of September through the 1st of October, so sort of a typical Anderson Valley harvest. 1994 was also the year that Roeder announced that they had inadvertently, and Hush as well, brought in phylloxera from a nursery. And so we started this massive planting project in our upper vineyards. And so this is Johnny's garden, and this is the pond that we are constructing, and then there's about 5 acres of vines that we're developing alongside it. And then our Middle Ridge vineyard. Jim Ball did not invent the name Middle Ridge. We did. It's a great name. And then this is our Middle Ridge vineyard here. And all of this went into Dijon clones that were planted in 1995.
With this wine, I feel sort of it's at a similar stage of kind of suspended development, I would say, is the 91. I mean, I'm really impressed with the youthfulness, but I'm also thinking that after 19 and 16 years, respectively, whether these wines are going to sort of blossom aromatically with secondary and tertiary aromas in the bottle.
You know, I have my admission here is that I'm not a really big fan of aged wines. You know, I'm a winemaker, and I have a different palate. I have a production palate, and I'm always thinking about the wine I'm going to make next year. And I'm hopefully the wine I'm going to make next year is going to be the best wine of my career. And so, and I'm always trying to make the best wine possible. I have a lot of respect for sommeliers, and I have a great deal of respect for wine buyers, because it's that palate which is interpreting what the market wants. It's that palate that is interpreting which wines they feel are going to age well. And they have a great sense of geography. And so, I like older wines, but they're sort of like an octogenarian actress who's kind of propped up there, and her eyes are going all around here, and you can just see her trying to remember her lines. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's at best they get like that. And, you know, I think at times they're almost, I don't know, for me, most of us don't age gracefully, right? And so they, you know, it's almost like elder porn, old wines. It's really not interesting.
I hope someone's recording this, because I'm a huge fan of octogenarian actresses. As a non-winemaker, I particularly find, I was talking at lunch with a couple from Oregon, that I find that it is a very underappreciated fact of wine is when they can age, and I don't think they have to become so old they can't remember their lines. But I particularly enjoy wine that grows more complex. And I'm just sort of a little interested in how these wines have held on to their youthfulness, sort of, but have, to my palate, not really blossomed. And maybe that's just they haven't had enough time in the glass, I don't know. I'm just...
Well, I think there are reasons, you know. Yeah. I mean, all kidding aside here, maybe not all, but I think that Anderson Valley fruit is age-worthy, and I think one of the reasons it's age-worthy is that we can attain ripeness without super high levels of alcohol. I think we have great acidity, and we have reasonable pHs here, and that helps these wines age. You know, I do like wines with, you know, 5 to 10 or 12 years. I think that's really where they're strike the best balance with refining all those rough edges and the, but they still have fruit.
Yeah. No, I love the acidity and the balance of these, and I like the tannins. I like, you know, obviously grape tannins and some stem tannins and those two, which I think are great. Let's move on to the 2000 wine. Hope you guys are tasting through these. And
this is our first pitcher. This is not an octogenarian. Does anybody know who this is?
The wine or the person?
The person.
Oh.
No, it's Zach's wife. It's Michelle.
Ah.
He was married to a teenager. No. She worked with us in 2000 when Zach Merck first moved to the Valley and helped us out. And so, you know, we're all kind of close neighbors here. The 2000 vintage, the one thing that came was a load of new tanks. We went from all macro fermentations that you saw with Manuel and Josefina that were plastic, and we designed some new fermenters, and they are 5 feet tall and 7 foot in diameter. And actually, the design was something I really had been working on and thinking about, and it was actually Greg LaFollette that convinced me that that I was on the right track. So still here, thank you. And then here are the tanks, and we're punching them down with our favorite punch down tool, which is a hoe that you buy over at the hardware store. I spent hundreds and thousands of dollars on stainless steel punch downs, and everybody still prefers their hoe. Mostly made with Ramon Cooperage, MTL. We do use Francois Ferrer barrels, again, medium toast. With barrels, we have a tendency not to toast any of the heads. Ramon was really the biggest push. They really pushed us to try making Burgundian using their barrels with no toasted heads. You know, it always made sense to me when I was making Cabernet and Syrahs that was a third of the surface area of the barrel and they should be toasted. But in fact, I think that there's better tannin development with untoasted heads. And we do go into our barrels right at the end of fermentation, so we go in dirty. There was a comment that Greg made about H2S, and when we get H2S up in dirty lees, we'll just sort of go from heavy lees in one tank, we'll just rack off into clean lees and sort of try to keep fresh leaves and use the, you know, a healthy fermentation to kind of clean up an unhealthy wine. And that seems to work pretty well. Go ahead. Oh, and then by 2000, some of the differences were that we were using, you know, cover crops and mowing those in. We were using pressure bombs to monitor vine water potential. These are just some, our new vineyards were starting to produce. So there are Dijon clones in this particular wine are 25%. We had given up whole cluster contact. So the first wine is 20%. The next wine was 15%. And there by 97 was the first year we had given up whole clusters. And the reason we had done that was because we really felt we were getting some herbaceous notes in the wine that I think the Anderson Valley has plenty of. And then this is the garden spot, now fully developed. And again, this is our marking corral, fully developed. You can see Corby Vineyard down there. There's also, I think, about 5% Savoy in the second wine and about 12% in this wine. They were the martini selections. And again, but we still continue to produce about 40 to 50% of the wine in macro bins every year. I took the wines up to the Steamboat Conference and had them parallel wines that had been made in each way. And the stainless steel open-top fermenters are more masculine, a little deeper, darker in color, a little more tannic. I think their cap temperature gets up a little bit higher because it's so much thicker. But, you know, you have the same wine in each of the fermentation types can exhibit both really top-end fruits and black fruits. some real masculine tannins and some feminine tannins. Okay, and then let's see. Well, we're composting all of our grape waste today, and that gets spread out. And this is a pre-leaf, pre-harvest de-leafing, and soil preparation in some places where we're recovering most of our vineyard water. And then this is, a lot of people have gone to vertical shoot positioning in their trellises, and we've kind of gone back to this modified T-top to kind of direct to direct growth, but also protect fruit from too much sun because we're getting too much puckering. And that we started putting in 2000. And I think for all these wines today, I want to thank Ted Bennett and Deborah Kahn, the owners of Navarro. They took these samples out of their personal collection.
Great. And we've just got a couple minutes left. I'd be really interested if there were questions or comments about the wine. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So the question is what's the maximum temperature in macro bins versus our open top tanks? The answer is really it depends on incoming fruit temperature. So we've gone back to harvesting at night now that the light systems are better and that we have more vertically oriented trellises. But if we can get the fruit in less than 60, those will go into macro bins, and as it warms up, you know, we'll put them into the open top tanks. Sometimes harvesting the fruit into macro bins late in the year, they almost don't get hot enough, and so generally we try to max out our cap temperatures about 80 degrees, though, 79, 80.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Casey is expressing his preference for younger fruit and younger wines, and I think that the 2000 is still drinking within its lifetime. And it, yeah.
Got time for one other comment or question, Steve?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, decanting is always one of those difficult things to do for 160 people.
But it's a good point.
It is a good point, and I think it does take, for older wines, it does take, the main point is, I think, that Steve's making is that older wines need to sit around and breathe and open up and be savored over some time and not just opened and slammed the way younger wines can be. You know, the one other point I wanted to make, all these wines were filtered into the bottle, but in each of these vintages, we also made a small quantity of non-filtered wines. We do about 10 to 20% of our production as a non-filtered product. We also charge $2 more just because we find that it's somewhat more risky. And I've recently gone back through those and compared vintages to vintages, and it would have made actually an interesting tasting for today. And what's interesting about that is that in all the non-filtered wines, I have a Brett-like bloom, a Brettanomyces or Pediococcus. I don't know what it is. And, you know, we can't even culture, really, all the stuff that's in wine. Not all of it will be can even be cultured. The wines didn't, when we tested them, they never tested positive for any kind of microbes. They were pretty clean. I mean, your odd acetobacter or something that couldn't really live. So we know that there must have been small populations there. The interesting thing about those wines from an ageability standpoint is that they have much better mouthfeel than the filtered wines. And they, the filtered wines in their youth had a much more fruit, and I think that these are great examples of wines with fruit that aged. But those wines, by comparison, there wasn't fruit there components as much as there was just this really lovely mouthfeel. And so that, you know, unintended secondary fermentation may not necessarily be as bad as, you know, we all were taught in school.
Interesting. Well, listen, thanks so much. We're going to move on. Thank you very much for this.